Okay, so today we're going deep on something that's, pretty much the core of what you'll be doing as nurses, right? Making sure births go smoothly, but also knowing exactly what to do when things get tricky. Because let's face it, not every birth is textbook perfect, right?
Okay.
And for you future nurses out there, this deep dive, this is where it gets real.
Yeah, you got it. This isn't just about the happy, straightforward deliveries. This is about being ready for anything,
Yeah.
especially when things don't go as planned. You know what we call that? Labor and birth at risk. And trust me, understanding this, that's your foundation. That's your power to make sure moms and babies are safe no matter what.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we're doing today. We're getting into the nitty-gritty, the how-to, and the why behind it of managing labor and birth when complications, pop up.
Think of it like a roadmap, right? We're navigating the twists and turns, all those potential bumps in the road. First, we'll tackle dystocia. That's the fancy term for difficult labor. We'll use the 4PS framework for that one. Then we'll look at preterm and postterm pregnancies, those timing challenges. And of course, we got to talk about labor induction and augmentation, getting things moving or giving them a boost. We'll cover VBAC2, vaginal birth after C-section. And finally, we'll equip you with the knowledge to handle those critical obstetric emergencies and understand the procedures that might be needed.
All right, so first up, dystocia. I feel like that could mean a lot of things. What exactly are we talking about when we say a woman's experiencing dystocia?
Basically, it means labor's not moving along like it should. Either it's slow, really slow, or it just stalls out completely. The normal process, the physiology of childbirth, something's off. And to really get a handle on it, we use this framework, the 4 Ps: powers, passenger, passageway, and psyche. These four things, they all play a part and they're all connected.
Got it. So starting with powers. What kind of problems with, the mom's ability to push the baby out can cause dystocia?
Well, with powers, it mostly comes down to the contractions. Are they strong enough? Frequent enough? Are they working together like they should? And then there's the mom's pushing. How effective is that in the second stage? So with contractions, we see two main issues. First, hypertonic contractions. These are the kind that are super frequent and often really painful for the mom. But here's the catch. They're not coordinated. They're not doing the work of opening the cervix or moving the baby down.
So it's like the uterus is working hard, but not smart. That's not getting anywhere.
Exactly. So what do we do? As nurses, we want to help mom rest, calm things down, make sure she's hydrated, give her pain relief, whether that's meds or an epidural, and just create a calm environment. This can sometimes help the uterus find a better rhythm, a more effective pattern. The problem is often that the top and bottom parts of the uterus aren't working together, so the cervix isn't dilating like it should.
Makes sense. And then there's the opposite, right? The hypotonic contractions.
Right, these are the weak ones, not frequent enough, irregular, no power behind them, not opening the cervix, not moving the baby down. So here we need to boost things, augment labor. Sometimes we use oxytocin, the synthetic hormone, to make contractions stronger and more regular. Or we might do an amniotomy, breaking the water bag to try and ramp things up, especially if the cervix is already starting to open.
All right, power's down. Let's move on to passenger, the baby. What can make the baby a difficult passenger, so to speak?
Oh, lots of things. Size, position, how they're coming into the pelvis, all of that matters. Malpresentation is a big one. That's when the baby isn't head down, head flexed, the ideal way to come out.
Right.
So you got breech, where the butt or feet come first, transverse lie, where they're sideways, face presentation, where the neck is extended back and the face leads.
Yikes. Okay, so not exactly the smoothest way through the birth canal. What do you do in these situations?
Depends on the specific malpresentation. Sometimes we try to turn the baby, do an ECV, external cephalic version. A doctor will try to gently guide the baby into a head-down position by pressing on the mom's belly.
I see.
But it doesn't always work, and it's not always safe. So if that's not an option, or if it fails, a C-section is often the safest route, especially for a transverse lie or a breech that just won't budge.
To avoid complications, right?
Exactly. And then there's the baby size, macrosomia. That's when the baby's big. Over 4,000 grams, like almost 9 pounds. A big baby can make vaginal delivery tricky, especially because of the risk of shoulder dystocia. That's when the baby's shoulder gets stuck behind the mom's pubic bone after the head is out.
Oh, wow. That sounds scary.
It is. It's an emergency, and we need to act fast. Nurses were right there assisting the doctor with maneuvers to free the shoulder. There is the McRoberts maneuver, where a mom bends her legs up really tight to her belly, and suprapubic pressure, where someone pushes down firmly above the pubic bone.
So you're trying to create more space, basically.
Yeah. Exactly, trying to get that shoulder unstuck. And documentation is super important here, noting every step, the timing, everything. Because there can be complications. Baby might have a brachial plexus injury, or mom might have a postpartum hemorrhage. We gotta be ready for anything.
Okay, so we've covered powers, passenger, now onto the passageway. That's all about the mom's pelvis, right?
Right. Is it big enough? Is it shaped right? Are there any blockages in the birth canal? Sometimes there's a mismatch. Cephalopelvic disproportion, CPD. The baby's head is too big for the mom's
So it's
pelvis.
like a puzzle piece that just won't fit.
Kind of, yeah. And if that's the case and labor's not progressing, even with good contractions, a C-section is usually the safest way to go. Otherwise, you risk obstructed labor and even uterine rupture, which is a whole other level of serious.
Right. Definitely want to avoid that. Okay, last P, psyche. How does the mom's mental state affect labor?
You know, this one's often overlooked, but it's huge. Stress, anxiety, fear, they all mess with the hormones, especially catecholamines like adrenaline. And what does adrenaline do? It puts the brakes on contractions, makes pain worse, and basically stalls everything out.
Like the fight or flight response taking over.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the body saying, nope, not a good time to have a baby. So our job as nurses is to create a calm, supportive environment. We're there for emotional support, pain management, whether that's meds or other techniques, clear communication, all of that. Breathing exercises, guided imagery, whatever helps mom relax and feel in control. That can actually help labor progress more smoothly.
So it's more than just making a mom comfy. It's about creating the right hormonal environment for labor to work.
Exactly. Okay, so that was a whirlwind tour of dystocia and the four Ps. Now let's talk about timing, preterm and postterm pregnancies. Preterm labor, that's when labor starts before 37 weeks, right?
Right. And I know that can be really dangerous for the baby. Why is that?
Well, babies born early, their organs aren't fully developed. They're at risk for all sorts of complications, like respiratory distress syndrome because their lungs aren't ready to breathe on their own, or infections because their immune system is weak. They might have trouble regulating their temperature, and low birth weight can cause feeding problems and other issues. And the earlier they're born, the greater the risk.
So what are some things that make a woman more likely to go into labor early?
Oh, there's a whole list. History of preterm labor, problems with the uterus, carrying multiples like twins or triplets, infections, especially urinary tract infections, chronic health conditions in mom like high blood pressure or diabetes, problems with the placenta like previa or abruption, a short cervix, stress, smoking, substance use, you name it. And sometimes we just don't know why it happens.
What are some signs that a woman might be going into preterm labor? Things nurses should watch out for.
It can be subtle. Regular contractions, maybe painful, maybe not. A change in Braxton Hicks contractions, those practice contractions. Lower back pain that won't quit, that dull ache. Pelvic pressure, like the baby's pushing down. Any bleeding or spotting. Changes in vaginal discharge, watery, mucousy, bloody. Cramping, maybe with diarrhea. Any of that. Gotta get checked out right away.
And what about cervical changes?
Oh, absolutely. If the cervix is starting to open or thin out, that's a big red flag. We need to know.
So how do you manage preterm labor? What's the nursing approach?
The main goal is to buy time, delay delivery as long as it's safe for mom and baby so the baby can mature more. We might give tetrodotoxicolytics, meds like magnesium sulfate, nifedipine, or indomethacin. These relax the uterus and stop contractions. Corticosteroids like betamethasone are really important too. These help the baby's lungs develop faster so they're less likely to have breathing problems if they are born early. Bed rest is sometimes recommended, although we're learning more about that all the time. Hydration is key, and of course, we're monitoring the baby constantly to make sure they're okay.
Okay, now let's switch gears to post-term pregnancy. That's when a pregnancy goes past 42 weeks, right? You'd think that would be a good thing, more time to bake, so to speak. But I hear there are risks with that too.
Yeah, that's a common misconception. More time isn't always better. After 42 weeks, the placenta, you know, the baby's lifeline, it starts to get old and less efficient. That can lead to all sorts of problems for the baby, like not growing enough or having problems during labor. There's also a higher risk of low amniotic fluid, the baby inhaling meconium, their poop, and the baby being really big, which, as we talked about, can cause delivery complications.
So what do you do when a pregnancy goes post-term?
We watch the baby like a hawk. Non-stress tests, biophysical profiles, checking their heart rate, movement, the amount of fluid, everything. If things are looking risky, we'll probably recommend inducing labor to get the baby out safely. How we do that depends on a few things, like how ready the cervix is and the overall situation.
Speaking of induction, let's talk about that in augmentation. We touch on augmentation with hypotonic contractions, but induction is when you start labor artificially, right? When would you do that?
Lots of reasons, like we just talked about, postterm pregnancy, or if mom has preeclampsia, high blood pressure, that can be dangerous. Or maybe she has a health condition that makes continuing the pregnancy risky, like diabetes or kidney problems. Sometimes the baby isn't growing like it should, or the water breaks early, but labor doesn't start on its own. And sadly, sometimes induction is needed if the baby has died. Augmentation, on the other hand, that's when labor has started, but it's just not going anywhere. The contractions aren't strong enough.
So what are the different ways to get labor going?
There are mechanical methods where we do something physical to the cervix, like putting in a Foley balloon and inflating it to help it open, or breaking the water bag, the amniotomy, that can sometimes jumpstart contractions.
And then there are medications, right?
That's right. Prostaglandins like misoprostol or dinoprostone, these help to soften and thin the cervix, get it ready for labor. And then there's oxytocin, the synthetic hormone given through an IV. It makes the uterus contract. So we use it to start labor or to make existing contractions stronger. But we have to be really careful with the dose, always watching for signs of trouble.
So no matter how you're inducing or augmenting, monitoring is key.
Absolutely. We're watching mom's vital signs, her contractions, how she's feeling, and we're monitoring the baby's heart rate constantly, looking for any signs of distress. One thing we really watch out for is uterine tachycystole. That's when the contractions are too frequent, more than 5 and 10 minutes, or they last too long. That can be dangerous for the baby because they're not getting enough oxygen.
So you have to adjust the meds or even stop them altogether.
Exactly. And sometimes we give tachycardia to slow things down. It's a delicate balance.
Okay, let's move on to VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean. Some women who've had a C-section can try for a vaginal birth next time, right?
Right. And there are some benefits. Avoiding major surgery, recovering faster, and for some women, it's a more satisfying experience. But VBAC isn't without risks. The big one is uterine rupture, where the scar from the previous C-section tears open. It's rare, but it's serious.
Are there times when VBAC just isn't a good idea?
Definitely. If the mom had a classical uterine incision, that's a vertical cut in the upper part of the uterus, or if she's had a uterine rupture before, or multiple C-sections, these all increase the risk of rupture too much. Also, if the baby isn't doing well or there are other complications, a C-section is usually the safer option. The type of incision from the previous C-section matters too. A low transverse incision is the best for VBAC.
So for women who are good candidates for VBAC, what's it like for them during labor? What do nurses need to be aware of?
Monitoring, monitoring, monitoring. We're watching the baby's heart rate constantly, looking for any subtle signs of distress that could mean the uterus is starting to tear. We're also watching mom's labor progress closely. If anything seems off, we act fast. And the whole team, the surgeons, the anesthesiologists, everyone's on standby, ready to do a C-section if needed. Communication is key. Everyone has to be on the same page.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. Now let's talk about the really scary stuff, those obstetric emergencies that require quick thinking and action, starting with umbilical cord prolapse. What is that and why is it so dangerous?
It's when the umbilical cord slips down through the cervix, the head of the baby. Basically, the baby's head or butt is pressing on the cord, cutting off the blood supply and oxygen. If that goes on too long, the baby can suffer brain damage or even die.
So what do you do if you see a cord prolapse?
It's all hands on deck. You call for help immediately. And at the same time, you put a gloved hand in the vagina and push the baby's presenting part up off the cord. And you keep it there. You might put the mom in a knee chest position or Trendelenburg, head down, to help gravity relieve the pressure. You get oxygen going for mom and you monitor the baby's heart rate constantly. And you prep for an emergency C-section stat. There's no time to waste.
Wow. Every second counts. What about placenta previa? What is that?
It's when the placenta is covering the opening of the cervix, either partly or completely. As the cervix starts to thin out and open, the placenta can tear and bleed, and that bleeding can be anything from a little spotting to a life-threatening hemorrhage.
And it's usually painless, right?
Right. Unlike placental abruption, which we'll talk about in a minute. But that's one of the tricky things about previa. It can be silent until it's a big problem.
This is what you do if you suspect a previa.
Absolutely no vaginal exams. You don't want to poke around and make the bleeding worse. You monitor the bleeding, mom's vital signs, and the baby's heart rate. Depending on how far along she is, how much bleeding there is, and how the baby's doing, we might just keep her in the hospital on bed rest and watch closely. Or If it's bad or the baby's mature, we'll do a C-section because a vaginal delivery is too risky.
Okay, now what about placental abruption? How is that different from previa?
With abruption, the placenta tears away from the uterine wall before the baby is born. It can be partial or complete, and it can cause bleeding, pain, and fetal distress. And the bleeding might be hidden, so you don't always see it.
So what are the clues that something's wrong?
Sudden, intense abdominal pain. Maybe bleeding, maybe not. The uterus feels rock hard and tender when you touch it. And the baby's heart rate might show signs of distress. Mom's vital signs might also be off if she's losing a lot of blood.
So what do you do?
Another emergency. We monitor everything closely, get IV access going, maybe order blood, and prep for a C-section, usually emergently. That's the fastest and safest way to get the baby out if it's in distress or mom's bleeding heavily.
Uterine rupture, that's another one that sounds terrifying. What is it, and who's at risk?
It's a tear in the wall of the uterus, and it can happen during labor or even before labor starts. It's super dangerous for both mom and baby. Women who've had a C-section before are at higher risk, especially if they try for a VBAC and their scar is thin or their labor is really intense.
What are the signs of a rupture?
Think sudden and dramatic, really bad abdominal pain, like a tearing or ripping sensation. Feeling like something's popped. Contractions might stop suddenly. The baby might seem to move back up in the birth canal. There might be bleeding or there might not be much. And mom might go into shock with a racing heart, low blood pressure, and mental changes. The baby's heart rate often crashes too.
So it's an absolute emergency.
Absolutely. We need to get that baby out and repair the tear ASAP. Blood transfusions are often needed, and sometimes a hysterectomy, removing the uterus, is the only way to stop the bleeding. After surgery, we watch mom closely for infections and blood clots. It's a tough situation all around.
Okay, last emergency on our list, amniotic fluid embolism, also called anaphylactoid syndrome of pregnancy. This is rare, but often deadly. What happens, and how do you manage it?
It's basically a super rare and unpredictable allergic-like reaction. Amniotic fluid, fetal cells, stuff from the baby, it gets into mom's bloodstream and triggers a huge inflammatory response. Her heart and lungs can fail. She can start bleeding uncontrollably. It's really bad.
What does it look like?
It usually comes on super suddenly. Mom might have severe trouble breathing. Her blood pressure plummets. She might have seizures or even go into cardiac arrest. And she might start bleeding from everywhere. IV sites, incisions, the uterus.
So how do you treat it?
It's all about supporting mom's body. We give her oxygen, put her on a ventilator if needed, give IV fluids and meds to raise her blood pressure. We also treat the bleeding problems, DIC, with blood products and clotting factors. Often we'll deliver the baby, but the priority is stabilizing mom. The truth is, even with the best care, the outlook isn't always good. It's just a really, really tough situation.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of serious stuff today, but it's all about being prepared, right? Knowing what to look for, what to do, when to call for help. That's what makes a great nurse.
Exactly. And speaking of interventions, let's talk about some procedures that might be needed during birth. First up, forceps and vacuum deliveries. When do those come into play?
Right. So those are used when pushing just isn't cutting it, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe mom's exhausted or the baby needs to come out quicker because it's in distress.
Right. But we only use them if the cervix is fully dilated, the baby's head is down, and the pelvis, and we know exactly which way the head is facing. It's not a first-line option.
And I know there are some risks.
Yeah. For the baby, there can be some bruising or cuts on the scalp, maybe a cephalohematoma, that's a collection of blood under the scalp. And very rarely, more serious things like bleeding in the brain or facial nerve palsy. For mom, there's a risk of tears, especially bigger ones than with a regular delivery. Plus, more pain and a higher chance of injury to the anal sphincter.
So, Avidin-assisted delivery, you're checking mom and baby super carefully.
Absolutely. For the baby, we're looking for any signs of trauma, like cuts, bruises, swelling, any asymmetry in the face. And we're checking their neurological status, too. For mom, we're checking for tears, making sure she's not bleeding too much, managing her pain, and teaching her about perineal care and watching for signs of infection.
Okay, last but not least, C-section. We've talked about it a lot already, but what are some other common reasons for doing one?
Aside from those emergencies we talked about, like previa, abruption, rupture, and the baby being in a bad position. Well, sometimes the baby's in distress and nothing else is working. Or the baby's head is too big for the pelvis. Or labor just isn't progressing no matter what we do. Sometimes multiples, like twins or triplets, need to be delivered by C-section, depending on their position and other factors. And sometimes it comes down to mom's choice after we've talked about all the risks and benefits of both vaginal and C-section delivery.
And what's recovery like after a C-section? What are the nursing priorities?
We want to make sure mom heals well, prevent any complications, and support her as she recovers. We're checking the incision for any signs of infection, watching her vital signs, getting her moving as soon as possible to prevent blood clots and get her bowels moving again. We manage her pain, and we're always on the lookout for bleeding or other complications like a uterine infection. We also help her with breastfeeding and newborn care and provide emotional support because it can be a lot to process.
Wow. So much to think about. This has been a really intense deep dive, but it's so important. As nurses, you are literally on the front lines of labor and delivery, making sure moms and babies are safe.
You said it. Knowing all these potential complications, understanding the why behind everything we do, and being able to put that knowledge into action, that's what makes a skilled and confident nurse. You are the difference maker.
And for our listeners, keep learning, keep asking questions, and never be afraid to speak up. It's your dedication and your sharp minds that make all the difference in those crucial moments. And on that note, think about how everything we've talked about today plays out in real life. How would you handle these situations? What other factors would you consider? Keep those brains working, and we'll see you next time for another deep dive.